You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including using horses in therapy, new fallout for the Curry County Sheriff, and the end of rural ambulance service in part of Klamath County. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And I'm Peyton Gast, JPR's Snowden intern.
And Peyton, you covered equine-assisted psychotherapy this week. Tell us, what is that exactly?
Yeah, so I headed over to Ruby Ranch Mental Health earlier this summer to visit a therapist who partners with horses to administer therapy, primarily for young people. And unlike traditional talk therapy that often happens in an office setting where it's just a lot of talking back and forth, Kim Ibarra, who owns Ruby Ranch and is the therapist I spoke to, said equine-assisted psychotherapy often happens outside, you know, with horses in the open air. And she said this therapy has been really helpful for a lot of teens who've experienced trauma in their lives. And what usually happens at sessions is Kim will let, you know, the clients decide where to do therapy. Oftentimes it's in their outdoor arena. And Kim will create activities for the client to do. So one example I gave in the story was, you know, leading a horse over a hurdle. And in the process of trying to get the horse to go over the hurdle, the child is learning perseverance and creativity and patience. And Ibarra said this kind of somatic or physical exertion is really helpful for kids with trauma because trauma is stored in the body. And she said that sometimes simply talking isn't, you know, enough to work through these issues that these kids face at home. So oftentimes this kind of therapy is supplementary with, you know, traditional talk therapy and stuff like that.
And so how is this different from other just regular interactions with horses?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that was also something that I was wondering about when I first started covering the story. And what Ibarra said was it's really the therapist or the equine specialist who can kind of take these activities like, you know, the hurdle and extract meaning from them to accomplish, you know, healing goals. And what I mean by that is Ibarra will make statements about the horse's actions throughout the session. You know, maybe a horse walks away from a cone, or maybe Roxy's one of the horses. Maybe she walks to a gate, or, you know, bickers with Ruby, another horse in the arena. And Ibarra will point out these things and ask the client to kind of explain how they interpret those actions. So one example Ibarra gave was if the two horses are kind of bickering with each other, maybe the client will say, "They're just like me and my sister when we fight." So some of those comments give Ibarra insight into her clients' lives and their stories. And from there, she'll choose what kind of therapy to continue with. And maybe it's more somatic or talk therapy based.
And you reported on some issues Ruby Ranch is up against. What are those?
Yeah, so Ibarra was saying that being in a rural environment, there aren't many providers who are able for her, you know, to hire. And that's for a couple of reasons. One of them was because, you know, equine-assisted psychotherapy is really niche, and therapists like Ibarra need to have an understanding of the practice before they can ethically and safely administer it. And the second issue is insurance. So Ibarra, you know, she used to work with the healthcare insurer Care Oregon, but in 2025, the group cut its out-of-network providers. It's non-contracted providers, and Ibarra was one of them. And so it led her to stop seeing three of her clients, and she had to, you know, cut many more on her wait list, unfortunately. But the issue is that her wait list is 5 months long, and so now she's taking AllCare, and she would like to hire another provider who also contracts with AllCare to help get that line down. But despite those issues, Ibarra says grants pass, they have a really great horse community where people kind of come together around the animal, and she says she's always looking to get involved with community partners and strengthen those bonds.
Okay, thanks so much, Peyton. Jane, you wrote a story just yesterday about a fire district in Klamath County canceling its ambulance service. Why did they decide to do that?
Basically, it all comes down to money. So we're talking about Klamath County Fire District 3, which is east of Sprague River. They cover a large rural area in eastern Klamath County. And they decided last week to cancel their ambulance service. They do get money. The fire district gets money from a tax levy, but that money has to be used for fire response and not for the ambulance. So the district has been providing ambulance services since late 2023, but they just can't afford to keep it going. They can't afford to keep running the ambulance. It just isn't sustainable. Their interim chief, Nate Hussey, says they are the fifth entity to try to run an ambulance in this region, and they've all failed.
And what about the math just isn't working out here for them?
There are a few reasons. So one of them is that ambulance calls are paid for through billing, and district leaders say a lot of their calls are for people who are on Medicare or Medicaid, and they say they only pay out about 15% of what the district bills for. So the district isn't getting paid, you know, fully 15% for the time and the work that they're putting in. The only way they would be able to make the ambulance viable under those conditions would be a really high call volume, so having the ambulance just running in and out. But that's really hard to do in such a large remote area. They say some urban districts can turn around a call in like half an hour, like they're out and back pretty quick. But Klamath County Fire District 3 will have 3 or 4 hour long calls sometimes because of how far they have to drive. Their district makes up about a quarter of the county geographically, so it's huge. And they also can't bill for calls if they don't transport anyone to the hospital. So if the call is canceled or the patient refuses to go to the hospital or someone has died and doesn't need to go to the hospital, the district doesn't get paid or billed for that, even though they may have driven hundreds of miles and hours to get there. So their chief, Nate Hussey, says the only solution that he potentially sees is a new taxing district that would be specifically for the ambulance to make it financially viable, but he doesn't think the residents really have the palate for that right now. But meanwhile, 10 people have lost their jobs at the district from working on the ambulance, including Chief Hussey, who was really pretty upset about the canceling. And he said he spent 100 to 120 hours a week staffing the ambulance over the last few years and really worked hard to try to not close it down.
And what's going to happen for residents in that area who need an ambulance?
This will basically increase their response times if they do call for an ambulance. The coverage in that district will now be divided among Chiloquin Fire and Rescue and Klamath County Fire District 1 and Basin Ambulance in Merrill. I've seen some information on Facebook that there just won't be any ambulances in this district anymore. That is not true. There will be coverage still in the district, but it will just take longer to get there. And the District 3 will still continue to respond to medical calls as first responders, but they will have a volunteer crew now rather than having full-time staff, and they won't be able to transport patients to the hospital anymore because they won't have the ambulance running. And it's interesting also, not only will this increase response times for the eastern part of the county, but it will also pull resources from elsewhere in the county too, so we'll see some big impacts from that.
Okay, thank you so much, Jane. Justin, you reported on developments in a story about Curry County Sheriff, and previously you'd reported on allegations against a sheriff made by county commissioners. What are commissioners alleging, and what's new here?
Yeah, so these allegations involve money given to the sheriff's department by a local nonprofit, the John G. Atkins Foundation. And that foundation has donated to law enforcement districts in the region, like Curry County Sheriff's Office. And commissioners have accused the sheriff, John Ward, and former sheriff, John Bishop, although this is mostly directed at Ward now, of not disclosing those donations and kind of spending the money they got from this foundation, you know, how the sheriff's department wanted without informing the county commissioners. So that includes the sheriff's department buying watercrafts like boats and jet skis, which were purchased for a search and rescue, likely, but also a retirement party for Bishop in a storage shed that was built on Ward's property. So tax records show the foundation donated about $390,000 to the sheriff's office between 2009 and 2023. And the county had no idea about those funds. So the commissioners hired a consultant to do an investigation of potential wrongdoing by Sheriff Ward. And that investigation was somewhat damning and concluded that Ward used, quote, deceit, dishonesty, and subversion to conceal his handling of these contributions. And that report drew the attention of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, where Ward was serving as director.
And what was the reaction of the Sheriff's Association?
They called a meeting to vote on Ward's, perhaps at first temporary suspension from the group, but it sounds like they wanted to give Ward a chance to defend himself. And he didn't show up, which is one of many complaints that commissioners have had against Ward. He doesn't come to county meetings. So the Sheriff's Association actually voted to ban Ward permanently from its board of directors and effectively just end his participation in the group.
And what has Ward had to say about the allegations?
He's denied wrongdoing. And in a statement to us, he said that that investigation the commissioners commissioned was full of hearsay. And he sounded skeptical of its objectivity because, like I mentioned, it was a project of the county commission. And Ward and the commissioners have not been getting along for years at this point. So commissioners sued Ward last year over his refusal to attend meetings, like I mentioned, but also his refusal to provide records and documents to the county. A judge largely sided with the county in that lawsuit, but commissioners say Ward has not followed that court order. He still isn't providing requested records. And I think it's important also to be aware of the context behind this kind of antagonism between the sheriff's department and the county. Curry County doesn't have a lot of money right now, and the sheriff's office has had to make a lot of cuts over the years. They've severely restricted patrol hours, for example, and a law enforcement levy actually keeps failing at the ballot. And so the sheriff's office gets its funding from the county, and there's this bad blood there as the county has just continually had to cut funding for the sheriff's department.
And have there been any charges against Ward or any criminal investigations?
No charges. Commissioners have sent information allegedly to a lot of agencies to investigate Ward, including the FBI, but we don't have any information on, you know, how far those investigations have gotten so far. The Oregonian reported that the Oregon Department of Justice reviewed some of the allegations against Ward, and it found that further investigation would not lead to any charges, but public opinion seems to be kind of turning. So last week, State Representative Court Boyce, who was once a Curry County commissioner, called for Ward to actually step down. So that kind of public distrust is growing, and we'll see where it ends up.
Okay, thank you so much, Justin. Roman, you got us an update on a Medford mystery we've been wondering about since at least last year. What did you find?
Yeah, it's about a Creekside Quarter, which, if people don't know, it's this proposed redevelopment downtown. It was brought forward by this private developer that would include a conference center, a hotel, shops. Eventually, this minor league baseball stadium was brought into the mix. And so the city had been talking behind the scenes with this developer, but they never actually told the public who it was. Before the city eventually put on the ballot an increase to the city's hotel tax that would subsidize the construction of this. So that was part of the story, was I was trying to figure out the name of this developer so people could actually understand who brought this forward, did some public records requests. We eventually found out it was this Southern California company called Perk Development, but they didn't put out the city put out a new request for proposals for this conference center earlier this year, and they didn't submit a proposal. And we don't know why they didn't respond to requests. But there was another company in Texas who did submit one.
And we actually kind of, as part of that records request, had a clarification on the story midway through the week.
Yeah, we got a clarification from the city about the developer. That's kind of one of the difficult parts of these public records requests. We were narrowing it down. We got some information that it was one developer when it was actually another. Part of the problem was that this local land use lawyer that was working for the developer and talking to the city is also working for the new developer who is also proposing to build the conference center. So it just kind of made things, very difficult. But we clarified things with the city and kind of worked with that. That's one of the issues we face with public records requests especially.
And what's next for Creekside Quarter?
They haven't decided, the city, whether or not to award this project to this new developer, Garfield Public Private. They could put out the request again and see if any other developers are interested. That baseball stadium that I mentioned is also under consideration. The city has an engineering study out right now trying to figure out a better estimate of the cost in order to build it. It could be built in the northern part of Hawthorne Park, but the city is also looking at renovating the existing Harry and David Field, and that is supposed to come back to the city this fall. So we'll get a better idea then.
Okay, thanks so much, Roman. And before we go, I want to circle back to Peyton Gast, who we've been lucky to have as our Snowden intern this summer. Peyton, do you have a favorite moment from reporting here?
I have so many memories that I could say. One of them that sticks out to me was when Roman and I went to Siskiyou County to cover this really big conservation easement. And we took the interviews along a super rocky and slippery waterfront, and it was incredibly precarious to walk along trying to get to a spot where we could do the interview, and there were wasps everywhere, and I was juggling the equipment, and it was just such a blast, and I'll remember that memory for a long time.
And a little danger helps form those memories. What are you up to next, Peyton?
Yeah, so I finished up my junior year at the University of Oregon studying journalism, so I'm headed back in the fall to finish up my degree, and then I head off into the world. But it's been the biggest honor to come down here and report for the summer, and I just feel so lucky to have been here. It's been awesome.
Okay, well, from all of us at JPR, thank you so much for joining us this summer. And that's it for the debrief this week. Thank you for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.